You Are Now in Real Time, written by Stan Cox and read by Sarah Cruz. In Real Time, Chronicle of a Fate Unknown is a monthly series of reports and commentary on cultural, environmental, and political events in the U.S. as they unfold in the pivotal months ahead. Last month, Stan discussed how election officials, racial justice and climate activists, and others are becoming targets of right-wing political violence and responding with nonviolence. In this episode, he speaks with some climate writers and activists who urge that movements respond to the multiple existential threats that society now faces by uniting across issues to confront all of them, including climate, together, no matter how long the odds against us. In Real Time, Part 5, A Better Brand of Pessimism. The Inflation Reduction Act that was passed by the U.S. Senate, and of this writing is very likely to be passed by the House, is being hailed by the mainstream climate movement, Congress members, and the media as the most important climate bill in U.S. history. That's a low bar and says more about our government's long record of failure on climate than it does about whether this law can prevent dangerous temperature increases in coming decades. The lion's share of spending in the IRA is directed toward production of infrastructure that generates and distributes energy and technologies that consume it. But there is no investment in a direct, surefire phase-out of fossil fuels. In fact, this legislation will do worse than fail to snuff out fossil fuels. Instead of shuttering gas and coal-fired power plants, it will reward them with subsidies or tax credits if they keep operating and capture the emissions. And rather than ban further drilling for oil and gas on federal lands, the bill guarantees that plenty of new leases will be issued. But wait, there's more. In exchange for his essential yes vote on the IRA, Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat, West Virginia, extracted the promise of a second bill that would streamline the permitting of energy infrastructure projects, including oil and gas pipelines and coal mines. Manchin's chief aim in this new bill was to ensure completion of the Mountain Valley Gas Pipeline through his state of West Virginia. Once in use, the pipeline will be responsible for 90 million tons of greenhouse gas emissions per year, while imperiling hundreds of streams and wetlands. Why climate's off the stovetop? General excitement over the IRA's support for renewable energy, affordable housing, and environmental justice, while justified, has not dispelled a heightening sense of dread and discombobulation that continue to permeate our society. The weather's going haywire. Representative government is under assault by anti-democratic extremists. The economy of the 1970s has returned, and the systemic racism never left. The death toll from gun violence keeps mounting, and state violence against people of color continues unabated. Humans can pay close attention to only so many crises simultaneously, so we perhaps should not be surprised that several surveys show climate change falling lower on the list of public concerns. Now, passage of the IRA may engender a dangerous new sense of complacency on climate. Oh good, that's one problem solved. All of this prompted me to speak with some perceptive climate writers and activists who continue to urge that movements unite across issues to confront all of these crises, including climate, all at once, however daunting that prospect may be. Aviva Chomsky is a professor of history at Salem State University in Massachusetts. She has written 7 books, most recently, Is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice, and Central America's Forgotten History, Revolution, Violence, and the Roots of Migration, both from Beacon Press. When I asked her about the seemingly perverse widespread apathy about climate, she said, I think there's still a strong sense that, oh, well, our institutions are going to take care of it. Okay, maybe that's the case with issues like abortion or gun violence that seem to have very clear and simple solutions that can be solved by our elected officials if we just elect the right people. But, she noted, greenhouse gas emissions are deeply embedded in myriad ways throughout society and can't be eliminated without a thoroughgoing transformation, and most politicians are allergic to that idea. To me, there's no candidate who has an adequate platform on climate anywhere in the United States. So, as a voter, why should I rank climate as an important election issue? I'd be much more likely to vote for someone who's going to protect abortion rights, because that's something where I actually see there's a difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. With that kind of calculus driving opinion poll responses, Chomsky says, I don't think it necessarily means that people don't care about climate. This difference in tractability between climate and other issues was illuminated a few days after Chomsky and I spoke, when my adopted home state, Deep Red Kansas, voted in a landslide to defeat an amendment to the state constitution that would have stripped away the right to an abortion. Needless to say, the probability of such a sudden dramatic victory on eradication of fossil fuels is microscopic. I also spoke with Richard Heinberg, a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and the author of 14 books, most recently Power, Limits and Prospects for Human Survival, New Society, 2021. Our ability to act at scale, he said, is being hampered by all this other stuff. Suddenly, all these crises are coming at us from all these different directions. So doing something really big and long-term about climate and our transgression of ecological limits gets pushed not just to the back burner, but off the stovetop altogether. Heinberg said that in the 1970s, when some environmentalists were arguing that industrialized societies cannot be sustained over the long term without deep transformation, the environmental establishment's response was, in effect, oh, well, we can't really do all of that. Therefore, he recalls, legislative efforts to fix the unsustainability of industrial society devolve down into little projects to target this area of pollution or clean up that toxic waste site or whatever. I think the general idea was that all these little efforts would eventually add up to something major, which they really haven't done. Now, half a century later, the political establishment remains stuck in little efforts mode. Liz Karasik, a visual artist and climate activist with the group Extinction Rebellion in Washington, D.C., XRDC, agrees that the urgency of fending off an array of political and human rights disasters has at least temporarily kept climate in the background. It feels like all of this is splintering us further in a lot of ways, because you have all of these specific problems that are intersectional and all feed back into one another. It's like they're just trying to keep dividing us, and that's the last thing we need right now. We don't have to accept this. There could be a twist, though. The fact that we are seeing so much of what we value being imperiled all at once can be energizing. Says Karasik, all of these threats are under the umbrella of an unjust system. It fundamentally has to be changed. And that's why, with Extinction Rebellion, we're disrupting business as usual. Chomsky also believes, based on her experience as a historian of Latin America, that cascading crises shouldn't inevitably trigger despair and apathy. Our culture of acceptance of capitalism, she says, just doesn't exist in the same way in the formerly colonized countries. They see very clearly how much exploitation occurs in the capitalist system, whether it's exploitation of labor, of land, of peasants, or of the natural world. She believes that the kinds of comforting myths about how capitalism works that permeate our society just don't work as well in regions like Latin America, and that opens up other, better routes to the future in those regions. How, for example, she asks, have Latin Americans united and brought about fundamental social change, either through armed revolution or through the ballot box or through some combination thereof? And why does the left seem so much stronger, even when they're in much more dangerous, difficult circumstances than the left in the United States? Chomsky offers one answer. In Latin America, we see the real strength of peasant movements, indigenous movements, African-descended movements, peasant struggles for land against a corporate-dominated economic model. You know, every Latin American revolution has had strong peasant participation, and every Latin American government has confronted the peasant struggle for land, which is a class struggle, and it's a global struggle because they're struggling against not only local elites, but also global corporations. That's something we don't have here in the U.S. Karasik thinks she may see a ray of light through the gloom, even in the U.S. At this year's Juneteenth celebration in D.C., one of the organizers was talking about how before COVID, there was so much momentum, so many people working across organizations, something really building, and then COVID really just took the wind out of the sails. But it's interesting. There's now a general sense that these relationships are coming back together across organizations. That same weekend at the June 18th Poor People's March on Washington, Karasik says, "You had all these hundreds of groups coming together, and across the climate movement, specifically in Extinction Rebellion, we are joining with local residents and marginalized people who are being affected disproportionately by the climate crisis. There are definite opportunities to unite, and we're definitely starting to sense that this is happening." Useful pessimism. In his recent writing, Heinberg has argued that in the affluent world, the ecological crisis is in part a result of what he terms deadly optimism. He described it to me this way. "We've now had 70 years or so of extreme optimism. Our public discourse has been dominated by the idea that we're always going to enjoy more, bigger, and faster, because that's good for business. But now we've reached the point where we can't continue down that road. And a lot of bills are coming due from that era of excessive optimism on climate change, but lots of other things too. So suddenly we have a kind of pervasive pessimism sweeping society." For decades, Heinberg has been warning of what he's now calling a great unraveling. In his book Power, he writes that in recent years, in his private conversations with scientists and activists, a common theme is that an unraveling looms in our near future. "We understand that a lot of our institutions are going to fail," he told me. "We're going into a difficult time and we're going to have to adapt, but we have to be determined to exclude the worst possible outcomes. If instead we were to just give up on doing whatever they can to make things better, if we were to spend all our effort only looking out for ourselves, the result would be a dystopian nightmare." The best alternative to either deadly optimism or fatalistic pessimism, he says, is sort of like what psychologists call defensive pessimism. Those folks choose an extraordinarily unappealing term, so Heinberg has suggested alternatives, including useful pessimism. But whatever we call this stance, he suggests, the motivating ideal might be stated as respecting limits and living well within them. Chomsky also advocates for channeling pessimism constructively, and that, she believes, will require even more on-the-ground organizing. "I almost feel like we don't even have enough of a critical mass in this country to engage in serious protest. We should be focusing on building that critical mass." In Witness for Peace, which I worked with a lot in Colombia, every time we had a protest or other activity, the question was, what's the ask? In Latin America, street protest has been criminalized, yet massive street protests occur nonetheless, and they generally have very clear and coherent asks, and they've often been successful. If we achieve the critical mass and if we have a coherent ask, we can do it too. Even though it looks grim, and it is grim for many already, says Karasik, every degree of warming we can prevent matters, so we can't let up. Pointing to a Yale University survey, finding that 28% of voters would support nonviolent civil disobedience by climate groups, Karasik said, "That's huge. There is a sense that people are starting to get really frustrated with the government's inability to do anything with this crisis, and are willing to push them harder. I think people are very aware of what the problem is, And she says they're coming to realize that nonviolent civil disobedience is a mechanism to get the government to pay attention and to make change. Regarding movements like the Poor People's Campaign and Extinction Rebellion that are striving for critical mass and do have very clear demands for systemic change, even against what could be the longest of odds, Chomsky was reflective. Yeah, I think we have no choice but to push harder despite everything on two grounds. One, because even if it seems impossible, we're making it impossible if we don't do anything. And two, because we just have to. Even if there is no hope of success, we still have to if we're going to live with ourselves. In Real Time is a project of Stan Cox, City Lights Books, and the Land Institute. The audio edition is hosted and read by me, Sarah Cruz. Bill Vitek composed and performed the theme music. For the written version of In Real Time, with links to sources, as well as to Stan's books, The Path to a Livable Future and The Green New Deal and Beyond, see citylights.com/blog. We're really interested in engaging with our listeners. Send your comments or questions to inrealtime@mailbox.org to join the conversation.